The reading is taken from 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 18 to chapter 4, verse 7. And this can be found on page 1148 of the Church Bibles. That's 1148. Let no one deceive himself. If anyone among you thinks that he is wise in this age, let him become a fool that he may become wise. For the wisdom of this world is folly with God. For it is written, he catches the wise in their craftiness. And again, the Lord knows the thoughts of the wise, that they are futile. So, let no one boast in men, for all things are yours, whether Paul or Apollos, or Cephas or the world, or life or death, or the present or the future. All are yours, and you are Christ's, and Christ is God's. This is how one should regard us, as servants of Christ, and stewards of the mysteries of God. Moreover, it is required of stewards that they may be found trustworthy. But with me, it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by any human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself. I am not aware of anything against myself, but I am not thereby acquitted. It is the Lord who judges me. Therefore, do not pronounce judgment before the time, before the Lord comes, who will bring to light the things now hidden in darkness and will disclose the purposes of the heart. Then each one will receive his commendation from God. I have applied all these things to myself and Apollos for your benefit, brothers, that you may learn by us not to go beyond what is written, that none of you may be puffed up in favour of one against another. For who sees anything different in you? What do you have that you did not receive? If then you received it, why do you boast as if you did not receive it?
Thanks very much, Becky. It's great that it's American food over at After Eights tonight, because I want to tell you about my visit to America last Easter. And I need to make clear that I loved America and that I met lots of Americans who I liked and who were very kind. If you're here and you're an American visitor, I'm really glad you're here. But Americans tend to talk as if they ruled the world, because they do. I had quite a bit of that, and I had this all afternoon before I decided to visit a church that we passed. And I walked in, and the person from the church came over to say hello. And this is the first thing he said. I suppose I must have done the kind of swivelly head thing, because the first thing he said was, "Bet you've never been in a church as old as this." I tried to rise above it. I really did. I tried really hard, but I'd had a long day, I'm very English, and my degree is medieval history, and I work here, and it was just too much. So, bet you've never been in a church as old as this. Oh, is it old? It looks pretty recent to me. What is it, 1650, is it? No, 1744. Based on designs by Christopher Wren. Oh, Wren! Yeah, we've got Wren churches all around us. Pause for just long enough. Our church is much older. we went from there. What are you like with proud people? I bet you've never been in a church as old as this. Can you smile and leave it? Or do you have to respond in kind? And how would you help a proud person who you loved? How would you help them? which is why we're in 1 Corinthians, as proud people who God loves and God wants to help. Last week, we went to 4 verse 6 to see that pride is the big problem in Corinth. 4 verse 6 is the summary of three chapters. I have applied all these things to myself and Apollos. See, they don't argue about whose church is the oldest, but about whose preacher is the best. So Paul writes about myself and Apollos for your benefit, so that you may learn by us not to go beyond what is written. See, their pride had taken them well across the limits set by the Old Testament. And so that none of you may be puffed up in favor of one against another. They're puffed up, they're full of themselves, and they're telling Paul that they're better than him and have better leaders than him now. And we'll see next week, there's a whole list of ways they think they're better than him. But the biggest ladder of all is wisdom. They're right at the top of the wisdom ladder. We come from a sophisticated Greek city. We're philosopher citizens of the nation that gave the world Plato and Aristotle. And you are a hick from Tarsus. And you're not even a hick who bothered to try and learn how to communicate at our level. Just turn back to chapter 2, verse 3. This is Paul's visit to Corinth. I was with you in weakness and in fear and much trembling, and my speech and my message were not in plausible words of wisdom. He's a hick with foolish, implausible words, who stood on a Greek debating platform next to the best in the world and trembled. See, the puffed up Corinthians have wisdom, and Paul doesn't. So they preferred Apollos, who was Paul's replacement. We don't know much about him, but it is easy to see why they preferred him. Acts 18 is, for your notes, where we meet him. Not only his Greek name, but he was eloquent. He spoke accurately and boldly, and he powerfully refuted the Jews in public. And the puffed-up Corinthians know enough about wisdom to recognize the real deal when they see it. So they chose Apollos over Paul, and the church split into factions. And 1 verse 11, Chloe's people come to tell Paul that on Sundays it's as bad as one group chants, "I follow Paul," and another group in the same church, "I follow Apollos." And they think they're bigger and better and more puffed up because of it. How do you help a proud person who you love? So in our verses 18 to 20, first of all, point one, give up wisdom. Give up wisdom. That's the first point. Give up wisdom, because the wisdom of this world is folly with God. This is a three-verse recap of chapter 1, and it is devastating. The whole competitive wisdom game that you're playing, give it up forever. You think you're wise, and you are deceiving yourself. The truly wise, verse 18, become fools in this age. And he's not suggesting you go home and take a drill at the front of your brain to reduce your IQ. He's saying that trying to keep up with the standards of Greek wisdom, trying to be the kind of Christian who looks acceptable to Greek culture, just give that up forever. And the reason, verse 19, for the wisdom of this world is folly with God. I had a friend at school, 3 years younger than me, who once said something I think he intended as a compliment. He was a Christian, he saw that I was a Christian, and trying to be a Christian in the school and helping lead the Christian Union and things like that. And he said, "When I'm in the upper sixth, I'm going to be just like you, but cool." And it would not be fair to blame Jesus exclusively for the fact that I wasn't cool. I think sporting ability and dress sense and hairstyle had a lot to do with it. But Christian and cool, that is an objective that is always going to be hard to achieve in the cut and thrust of social life in your teens. Well, the Corinthians think they are just as Christian as you, but wise, intellectually credible in a way our culture can recognize. Verse 18, no, says Paul, let no one deceive himself. Verse 19, the wisdom of this world
is folly with God. It's the same as in every other area of the Christian life. To follow Jesus is to do an exchange. In Mark chapter 8, probably the beginning of this term, if you were doing that in small groups, Jesus tells disciples, if you want real life, you need to give up your life now. And if you try to hang on to your life now, you will lose out on real life. It is the same with wisdom. You need to choose. You can have wisdom now, have everyone telling you how clever you are and how sensible you are. But if you go that way, you lose real wisdom. Because the wisdom of this world is folly with God. These verses are the summary. Just turn back to chapter 1 for some of the details. Why is the wisdom of this world not so great? Because verse 21, the wisdom of this world has not led to knowing God. And verse 25, God's wisdom is so much greater that even God's foolishness, even what looks like foolishness in God, is wiser than the best of Plato. And in fact, 2 verse 14, the wisdom of this world is incapable of understanding about God. That is one of those statements to get you sacked in modern Britain, isn't it? Aristotle, Confucius, Buddha, Jung, Freud, and Dear Deirdre, they are all unable to understand God. Not because people who become Christians are cleverer than people who become Buddhists, but because Jesus is the wisdom of God. Jesus, by the Spirit of God, has revealed the wisdom of God. So the right thing to do, if you really value wisdom, is to become a fool. That's Paul's recommendation in 3 verse 18, which is not about brain surgery, it is about humility. If you're still in chapter 1, then verse 18, it is to believe in the word of the cross, in what God has revealed, which means that you tap into the wisdom of God, which is behind the universe at the deepest possible level, makes sense of the way the world works, the way people work, everything, which ought to have wisdom-seeking Corinthians salivating, except for this one catch. You will be wise, truly wise, but to the rest of the world, you will look like idiots. I'm going to be just as Christian as you, but intellectually credible. I wonder how many of us have struck that sort of deal with Jesus. It's always going to be a danger for us here at 6 p.m., I think. Let's just do a quick survey. This isn't too embarrassing. How many people here have a degree or are studying for one at the moment? How many? Okay, that's interesting. And how many of those people have done or are doing some kind of additional study, another degree, a master's or an accountancy, something? Okay, that's interesting. In the UK, the national percentage is 20% with a first degree or more. I think 50% of 18-year-olds now are going into further education. So we're a bizarrely over-educated group, and I am in national terms. And I guess a weird amount of us do jobs where the part of our body we use the most is our brain. And maybe that isn't you. Maybe you'd say, I'm not someone like that. I don't read books and I haven't thought deeply since I was last pulled over by the police. But still, still we're a culture that loves the brain, aren't we? Can you be quick thinking on Jonathan Ross? Can you take on Anne Robinson on The Weakest Link? Can you win the argument in the pub? So, Christian people here, have you faced up to the realization that it is not possible to be a Christian and be thought wise by the standards of the culture around us? That was obvious tonight, wasn't it? So Lucy going back to a dangerous country, or the brother she spoke of prepared to die and leave behind wife and children. No one's ever going to say, oh, I see, that makes lots of sense. You're really wise. But how about in the UK, in our Christian country? Maybe we understand it would be difficult to be a Christian and, I don't know, defend your point of view on Mock the Week or something like that. But if you're like me, you tell yourself that they're unfair, the sort of clever people on the telly. They're unfair, they go too quickly, they don't listen, they wouldn't give a Christian a chance to explain how it all makes sense, really. I'm a clever person, I could convince them I was clever if we just sat down and talk about it. And I just don't think that's true. On Friday afternoon, I was listening to quite a different program, a phone-in on LBC Radio, and they had half an hour on a vicar who had done something a bit controversial, not terribly off the wall, something I think we'd do here as well. And the people who ring in on LBC, I don't know how to be nice about this, they're not chosen for their professional commentary. They're not chosen for their qualifications. But you or I would not stand a chance. Not a chance. Not a chance of persuading the audience. Not a chance of being heard as reasonable and intellectually credible. And I wonder if your ego and your pride is prepared for that kind of abuse. I wonder if that was in the exchange you made to become a Christian. And I think as Bible-believing evangelical Christians, we're particularly likely to care too much about how wise we look. Lots of reasons. I think partly that's because 50 years ago in this country, there was genuinely a sort of anti-intellectual side to being a Bible-believing Christian. Studying was dangerous. It made you believe wrong things. So let's not study and let's not read. And we got a reputation for not being able to think. And over the last 50 years, people like John Stott have changed that. And evangelical scholarship and teaching and research is now first class. But everybody still thinks we're thick. I had lunch just the other day with a very friendly atheist, and this was sort of his position on it. He decided Christianity was nonsense when he was 10. He hadn't looked into it since. He thought the Gospels were written hundreds of years after Jesus, which is just embarrassingly factually incorrect, and he had not read them. But on that level of thought and research, he assumed he was my intellectual superior in every way. And I think that's just normal, isn't it? And because the position of evangelical scholarship is now so much healthier, I just wanted to tell him all about it, as if that would bring him round. And he'd say, oh, now I see, Charlie, you are a clever person. You know, surely now we pay our dues in big, fat, heavy, boring books. People must accept that we're wise. I think we're also vulnerable because we've always put lots of energy into defending the faith. And can I say, that is a great thing to do, a brilliant thing to do. That's what I tried to do with this man over lunch. If someone's interested in Jesus but hasn't heard the evidence for the resurrection, then we need to tell them. That's what Paul does in chapter 15 of this book for 11 verses. And the arguments are good. And I'm convinced that on a purely neutral, rational basis, it is the clever thing to do to be a Christian. If you're here and you're not persuaded by that, please look at the evidence. We're not afraid of the evidence. We're not afraid of any question. I think there is good answers and good evidence. In Corinth, Acts 18, Paul reasoned and tried to persuade Jews and Greeks. But if you expect the wiser culture to roll over and say, oh, now I see, you were right all along, you are the wisest link, then you will always be disappointed. And I think this is all about leaders, isn't it? The argument in Corinth. I think we have a real risk of pegging our self-worth to the wisdom of our leaders, the wisdom of our leaders in cultural terms. So Saatchi has a PhD in science, so it's okay to feel all right about believing in Jesus. And you know, William was an army officer, so he's a competent leader of men. So it must be okay to be a believer in Jesus. And I have no idea what I bring to the party, but we pin things on our leaders. Because to keep our pride intact, we need to look wise to the world. So the wisdom of the world at large begins to invade the church. If the full foolish gospel of Paul can't get you recognized as wise, then you just adapt the message. I'm going to be as Christian as you, but wise. And that's the story of the church over the last 100 years. And the shock for these people, I think, is where Paul takes them in the Bible. Verse 19 is a quote from Job chapter 5. And verse 20 is a quote from Psalm 94. You see, I guess they thought they had the Bible on their side. There's lots in the Bible about being wise, whole books on it, books like Proverbs, and they say that's all we're doing. We're wise. And Paul just points out there's a lot of other stuff in the Bible about wisdom. In Psalm 94, they ask God to judge the proud. And suddenly you notice all through the Bible, wisdom and pride go together. Wisdom and pride. So in Psalm 94, ask God to judge the proud for all their wickedness because they think God can't see them. So they're actually fools. But our verse, the Lord knows the thoughts of the wise, that they are futile. Or Job 5 is even worse. You have high and mighty and wise and crafty people, and they're the ones that God will put low. And you have lowly people, humble people, trusting in God people who seek God, and they will be set on high. It's the same thing with the quotes from Isaiah in chapter 1. Wisdom is good in the Bible when it is God's wisdom. But wisdom, if it's opposed to God, is folly to God. And God's going to catch the wise in their schemes. So give up wisdom. So, two consequences. Second point, so verses 21 and 23, give up boasting. So give up boasting because your leaders all belong to you anyway. Now, if I was Paul, point two here would be very, very different. So think who Paul is. He has set up this church. He's endured persecution to get them started. He's planted the seed. He's laid the foundations. And they prefer this bloke called Apollos because he's a bit better at flowery speeches. So Apollos looks wiser by the standards of Corinth. And Paul has just shown us that that doesn't matter at all. Looking wise doesn't matter. So my next point, if I was Paul, would be about why Paul is really better than Apollos, wouldn't it? If all Apollos has going for him is that he sounds wiser and the wisdom of this world is folly with God, then Paul is home and dry, isn't he? I'm an apostle. I got there first. I've been a Christian longer. I've founded more churches. He could go on and on and on. And Paul actually says, give up boasting. Your leaders all belong to you anyway. See, the kind of boasting he wants them to give up isn't, I'm better than you. That was chapter 1, I think. But boasting in men, verse 21, which is the my preacher is better than you. He's taking the wind out of his own cheerleaders as much as he is out of Apollos' cheerleaders. No more boasting like that if all things are yours. Paul belongs to you, Apollos belongs to you, Cephas belongs to you. So is Apollos good at public speaking? That's good, isn't it? That must have been very helpful to you in Corinth. Aren't you glad he belongs to you? And is Cephas the great celebrity disciple of Jesus, Peter the rock? Well, that must have been very encouraging to have him come and visit. Aren't you glad he belongs to you? Paul isn't worried by these men. He's not worried he might lose out to them. They aren't rivals, and they all belong to the Corinthians. And it's silly to fight over what belongs to you anyway. I want to try and illustrate that. And to do that, you need to imagine you live in a monastery. If that's difficult for you, imagine you live in a sort of really effective communist society. And there you are, and everything you own in common. So the monks near me in Somerset, they used to take this very seriously. You never talked about my pen. It was always our pen. Even if it spent all of its life in our pair of trousers that I always wore in our study, in our desk. And if you give the monks a present, you give it to all of them. So it's our Thunderbirds DVD and our box of chocolate, slightly more reluctantly. So now imagine one of the monks comes back, strutting back from the weekly grocery shop in Radstock. And he parks the lime green Renault 5 in front of the monastery and swaggers into the hall. I'm better than the rest of you. I drive a Renault 5. I'm the meanest monk on the motorway. What would they say? What would they say? They'd say, Brother Wilfred, we all own the Renault 5. Yeah, I'm glad you like it, but it's ours. It's mine too. And actually, we have other vehicles. There's the bike that Brother Anselm used to go to the bike paper shop, and there's the tractor. And it just doesn't make sense to say you're better because of the Renault 5, because you own the bike and you own the tractor, and all things are yours. And we'd let you drive the tractor more often if it wasn't for the unfortunate incident with the Archbishop's hat. It just doesn't make sense, if we all own it, to think you're better. All things are yours, whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas. And he doesn't stop there. What follows is to Paul and Apollos as a Renault 5 is to the space shuttle. Or the world, or life, or death, or the present, or the future, all are yours. And you are owned too. You are Christ's, and Christ is God's. Why are you arguing when you own everything? And you are kindly and generously owned by God. Do you see what he's done? It's the same thing he did last week when he called them God's field and God's temple. How do you help a proud person? You reassure them. That's how you help a proud person. Yes, this is a wonderful old building. 1744, that's brilliant, that's very old. And even if it wasn't very old, it'd be really kind of you to stop and talk to me. And God cares about every church in the world. And it's a pleasure to be here in your church. That's how you help a proud person. Yes, you are very, very important, Joe Corinthian. God cares about you so much, he's come to live with you. And he's given his life for you, so that life and death and the whole world is yours. And you know, he feels the same thing about Jane Corinthian. He would die for her, and he's given her life and death and the world as well. I think that's one reason why we are so quick to fight other Christian groups here at St. Helens. I don't mean sort of as church as a whole, but sort of when we're out socially or in other Christian groups or in the Christian Union at university, something like that. See, there is a time to take a stand for the truth, but if we need a fight to prove that we're better than other people, then the answer is just to remind ourselves that God actually does love us and cares about us. He has given us everything. We've nothing to prove to him, so we can hold off fighting everybody else and proving it to them. So here's what I'm going to try and do next time I'm about to open my mouth with something like, my church is better than yours. I'm going to try and run through verse 22 in my head first. All things belong to me, including his church leader, or his church resources, or his opportunities for the gospel. All things belong to us together, and he and I belong to Jesus. So I can just do that quickly in my head, and then see if it still needs saying after that. So that's one consequence, give up boasting. And last consequence, verses 1 to 5, give up judging. So give up wisdom. So give up boasting and give up judging, because your leaders are only accountable to God. So if you give up the human standard of wisdom, then you can give up boasting about where your leaders come on that scale, and you can give up judging them on how good they are on it. So the command is there in verse 5, therefore do not pronounce judgment before the time, which is give up judging, because there will be a day when leaders will be judged. And that's the day when Jesus comes back. And he is the only one that does that. So if the standard is human wisdom, then anyone can judge a leader. All sorts of measures and systems you can get to do that. But in fact, wisdom is no good for that. So leaders can only be judged by God. Verse 1, they are servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. So verse 2, the standard they work to is the same as human stewards. Are they trustworthy? Does their master think they're trustworthy? And human wisdom can't see that. Human beings can't see that. And Paul gives us two verses on his attitude, verse 3 and verse 4. I've only had one friend, I think, ever, who really didn't seem to care what other people thought about him. And it is a very, very attractive quality. I don't know if you know people like that. He had real freedom to act. He was able to do what he wanted to do or what he thought was best and just let other people sort out their responses and worry about it. That sort of person makes a very, very good friend. He's your friend because he's decided to be, and you can trust him to stay that way. And that sort of person also makes a very good Christian leader. See, for Paul, verse 3, it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by any human court. It's not because he's self-absorbed. In fact, I do not even judge myself. And verse 4, that wouldn't work anyway. He's innocent as far as he knows, but the only judge who counts is Jesus. And there will be a time, verse 5, when the Lord will come, and he will judge and bring to light the things now hidden in darkness and will disclose the purposes of the heart. So one day we'll find out who was better, Apollos or Paul. And God will not call the Corinthians as expert witnesses on that day. You know, Corinthians, I see you are experts in Greek philosophy. Perhaps you'd give us your opinion, would you, on who was the more faithful steward of the gospel? God will look inside their hearts and judge on the basis of all the information. And Paul isn't terrified by that, which is interesting, isn't it? You think he might be, the thoughts of all our hearts laid bare. But I think I know why. I think it's the judgment of other people really that is terrifying, because I really don't trust sinful people like me to be very understanding. Whereas God, I know better than that. I know what God is like, and I know that he is merciful and forgiving and loving and kind. And Paul says, on that day, each one will receive his commendation from God. Just as a quick aside, this sort of teaching, I think, is one thing that's good about the Church of England system. We don't often get to say that, but I think that's a good thing, in that in the Church of England system, Christian workers aren't judged by the congregation. They belong to them, they serve them, but William is answerable to God, strictly employed by God in English law, not by anybody else. Judgment belongs to God, and waiting to that day, which gives huge freedom, I think, to a Christian leader. It's a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by any human court. I hope you find William listens when you tell him things and is willing to take advice and all that sort of thing. But ultimately, it's not what you sometimes see in churches, where the leader is paralyzed by having to win the approval of everyone in the congregation. See, there is a place for judging in the church. Just look across at 5 verse 12. Which says, is it not those inside the church whom you are to judge? If you see someone in the church committing incest, you don't say, oh, well, you know, God will judge when Jesus comes back. You can judge and discipline, but give up judging here is about give up judging between two good, faithful Christian leaders. Give up judging that is just basically designed to make you look better. I'm with him and he's better. And when I do that, I never call it judging quite. When I do that, I always include half a sentence about how good the person is as I do some sort of wise discernment of some of their unfortunate weaknesses. And here's the worry for me, or the revealing thing for me, I think. It's when I get a real buzz out of being wiser than some major Christian leader. That's the giveaway. When the purpose of the judging is to puff me up. So, of course, John Piper gets a bit overexcited, doesn't he? What's the purpose of saying that? Or, you know, John Stott, did he go a little bit soft over time? Did I hear that? Or, you know, some other leaders, they're a bit pushy, aren't they? Or as these leaders, they're a bit slow to act, a bit timid. And do you see, I could be right every single time, but if the buzz I'm getting is all about me, all serving to puff me up, then that is judging I need to give up. Isn't this an amazing response to a church that's rejected Paul? There's no attempt at all to get back on top, to win the fight. He diagnoses the problem is pride. He gives three commands: give up wisdom, give up boasting, give up judging. And next week we'll see that the pride over wisdom thing is just the first one, just the first of many issues they have. But behind all of it is reassurance. That's why the proud child screams and rants and fights. God does care about you, his temple, his people, his child. Let's wait for his judgment and his day. Shall we pray? All things are yours. Father God, praise you so much for your love for us, that you give us life and death and the world and the present and the future. All is secure in you, that we belong to you and you love us and care for us. Please forgive us for our attempts to look better than people around us with whom we share everything. Please create in us a spirit that is not puffed up, but is humble and trusting and willing to trust you for your wisdom not concerned to look wise in the eyes of those around us. Please give us that love and that confidence in you. In your Son's name. Amen.